I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, war in the Middle East. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dissolved a close group of military advisors. What it means in the push for peace. Overseas trip. Russian President Vladimir Putin is headed to North Korea tomorrow. How the White House is responding. Saying goodbye. We remember longtime Catholic radio host Al Cresta, who died over the weekend at the age of 72. And growing pains. Pope Francis reminds the faithful that the seeds of the gospel take time to bloom. We'll explain these stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. Our top story tonight, questions around Israel's tactical pause of military activities along a road in southern Gaza. According to the United Nations, more than 2 million people are dealing with what it says are unspeakable humanitarian conditions. Israeli officials say the pause is one way to solve the problem of aid distribution and claim humanitarian organizations aren't taking advantage of it.
So far, we haven't seen the UN take full advantage of this step. Israel remains committed to facilitating aid and working with the international community to see the aid make it to where it is needed.
We're urging again the international organizations to do their job and to make sure that this stuff that are outside here will be distributed to the people of Gaza.
But aid agencies are pushing back on those comments. The United Nations blames Israel for enforcing unnecessary and drawn-out inspection procedures at the crossing and says that fighting within Gaza has hampered their distribution efforts.
For the United Nations at the highest level, my executive director, the secretary general, it has to be a ceasefire. And I think certainly, again, coming back to Gaza now and seeing, of course, that as hard as it is for viewers to understand how much worse this has got, it's critical we do. This cannot be normalized.
In the midst of all this, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu dissolved his war cabinet. It comes just 1 week after the resignation of opposition leader Benny Gantz. And for more, let's bring in Brent Sadler. He is a senior research fellow for naval warfare and advanced technology in the Allison Center for National Security at the Heritage Foundation. Brent, so good to be with you today. So what does it mean for Israel's war cabinet to be dissolved?
Well, for the system, the parliamentarian system that the Israelis have, the formation of the war cabinet in October of last year was a political move to signal unity with opposition parties. And it served as a political mechanism to exercise or at least to engage with Israel's allies outside, like the United States. But again, operationally, the IDF is largely operated with unchanged. And with the dissolution of the war cabinet, it just is a recognition that the political environment has changed and the need, or at least the perceived need, to have a coalition government is less necessary. But again, the operations won't be impacted on the ground.
Brent, I know a lot of people are wondering this right now, but who is left in Netanyahu's inner circle?
Well, I think he's got a mix of more far right or right leaning members in his inner circle. I think he's going to continue to rely on that council, but I don't think we're going to see any of the more extreme measures that would be more troubling, a reversion to pre-2008 type of presence of Israeli settlements in Gaza. I don't think we're going to see any of those come to fruition, given how much has already transpired in the last 10-plus years.
Yeah, and when word of the tactical pause first came out, apparently the Israeli Prime Minister reportedly criticized it. What does that signal to you about Netanyahu's relationship with the IDF? Is there cause for concern here?
I don't think so, not at least yet. Nothing that I have seen would indicate that there's a split or one that would be a serious concern between the military operational needs on the ground and the political leadership in Jerusalem. The temporary opening of a corridor for supplies, I think as earlier in your segment, I mean, this is intended to placate American concerns, I think, primarily. But again, it's not being fully utilized. of course, the IDF is going to be concerned that if an opportunity opens up during these timeframes or in these corridors to take out Hamas leadership, that they may be constrained. But again, there's a bigger risk here. And in the geostrategic realm, that is Israel maintaining its very critical relationship and alliance with the United States.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. Brent, always great to be with you. Thank you so much for your analysis and insights. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
President Joe Biden welcomes NATO Secretary Jens Stoltenberg to the White House for a bilateral meeting. Their discussion comes as Russia and Ukraine remain locked in battle. The war that shows no signs of ending is Europe's biggest conflict since World War II. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports.
Tracy, the Biden administration says no nation should be allowed to conquer another nation by force, period. And the U.S. will stick by Ukraine until Ukraine prevails and peace prevails.
Russian missiles hit an apartment in Ukraine. Dozens dead or wounded in the recent attack. Since the war started, Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion, killing or injuring hundreds of thousands of people.
Together, we're deterred further Russian aggression in Europe.
And in the Oval Office today, President Joe Biden sits down with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
And we strengthen NATO's eastern flank, making it clear that we'll defend every single inch of NATO territory.
The Secretary General's visit comes as a record number of NATO countries meet their defense spending targets.
They show that across Europe and Canada, NATO allies are this year increasing defense spending by 18%.
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin heading to North Korea, expected to meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un for talks as they deepen their alliance. There are growing concerns about an arms arrangement between the two. In the White House press briefing room today, this reaction.
Yeah, look, no surprise that he went to North Korea after his so-called election. A little nail-biter that was. He was going to go on a little bit of a charm offensive here, and that's what he appears to be doing.
And this past weekend, at a summit, 78 countries in Switzerland jointly calling for the territorial integrity of Ukraine to be the basis for any peace agreement to end the fighting. But Russia was not there.
And Putin could stop this war tomorrow.
The U.S. ambassador to NATO says Russia is the aggressor.
Oh, he started it over 2 years ago, and he's the one that could bring an end to this senseless and unprovoked war of aggression in Ukraine.
Also tonight, NATO leaders will meet here in Washington, D.C. next month, and it could be a pivotal summit. And NATO is growing its newest members, Sweden and Finland. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
There are signs of a thawing in the complicated relationship between Australia and China. The Chinese premier met with Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to discuss issues like trade barriers between the two nations. This follows a period where Beijing had banned contact with Australian officials. Albanese described the discussions as constructive. This was the first visit by a Chinese premier in 7 years. Well, a concerning new report from the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General. The agency is issuing a stark warning stating DHS has not been effectively screening and vetting non-citizens and asylum seekers entering the United States. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now with more. Eric.
Well, good evening, Tracy. Yes, bottom line, this report is downright scary when it comes to national security. It reveals that inadequate screening and vetting of individuals entering the United States is not taking place and is actually taking place. And its release coincides with the arrests of 8 individuals from Tajikistan suspected of having ties to ISIS. They were arrested in a nationwide sting operation last week. Ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Lindsey Graham, sharply criticized the Biden administration's border policies at the southern border.
So I am hopeful that the administration will take this report from the DHS Inspector General and take it to heart and make reforms. Don't let people into the country until they've been fully vetted.
Senator Graham is now demanding the full Senate be briefed about the threat of ISIS fighters entering the U.S. through the southern border. And he's not the only one speaking out.
It's obvious that we are doing zero vetting. I mean, we have terrorists coming in, we have communist Chinese, and I guarantee you when China rolls on Taiwan, these communist Chinese, the over 100,000 that are in our country, are not going to run down to the Marine Corps recruiting station and sign up.
The only thing Biden did is reversed all the policies that President Trump had in place. So if anything happens in this country, and it will, with a terrorist incident, all the American civilians that are being raped and murdered by illegal aliens that are here, that all rests on Joe Biden's shoulders.
The DHS Inspector General report adds that without dedicated technology and resources, U.S. authorities may not properly identify asylum seekers. It states, quote, DHS will remain at risk of admitting dangerous persons into the country or enabling asylum seekers who may pose significant threats to public safety and national security. Democrats say they, too, are concerned, but defend the current administration, saying the entire system needs reform.
Well, I'm concerned by some of the recent reports of others going, using the southern border as a way to get into the country. I think the president is trying to do all he can to improve security there.
The Biden administration has been very strong on this, and we, of course, had great bipartisan legislation that was moving through the Senate, which essentially got vetoed by the fourth branch of government, Donald Trump, who said he did not want to see a border solution.
Earlier today, Senators Lindsey Graham and Rand Paul sent a letter to DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas requesting additional information about the arrests of those suspects linked to ISIS. You may recall at a recent hearing, FBI Director Christopher Wray testified that foreign terrorists are among those crossing at the border and, quote, are a source of great concern. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Now, summer officially arrives this Thursday, but things are already heating up as a sweltering heat dome descends upon a large portion of the United States, bringing potentially record-breaking temperatures. According to the National Weather Service, over the next several days, folks in the Midwest and the Northeast could see up to five straight days of temperatures of at least 95 degrees. Extreme heat warnings are currently in place in a number of cities, including Chicago, Pittsburgh, Boston, and in New York. And joining us now to talk more about all this is John Neese, Associate Head for Undergraduate Programs in the Department of Meteorology and Atmospheric Science at the Pennsylvania State University. Prior to joining Penn State's faculty, he was Chief Meteorologist at the Franklin Institute Science Museum in Philadelphia and an on-air storm analyst at the Weather Channel. John, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. So tell us, what exactly is a heat dome and what causes it?
Well, first, thanks for having me on, Tracy. I think that heat dome is just one of those terms that the media has latched on to. Essentially, when large masses of air warm up, the air tends to expand when air warms, and it tends to form a sort of a dome. But you can just think of it as an extended period of warm weather, generally speaking, 5 to 10 degrees above average. That's the practical impact.
Yeah, and John, I had mentioned of at least, you know, temperatures of at least 95 degrees, but it's going to get a lot hotter in some places. Tell us how hot it could get, and which areas of the country do you have your eye on or are most concerned about?
Yeah, this is particularly the Northeast. And one of the things to keep in mind here is that last summer was not that hot. And so folks haven't seen temperatures this high for two summers. And in some places, for example, I looked at Philadelphia, where I spent five wonderful years. Starting tomorrow, Philly's supposed to have six straight days of 93 degrees or higher temperatures, according to the Weather Service. Now, the last time that happened in the month of June was in 1925. So this is kind of early to have weather this warm, and it won't get that cold at night. I mean, temperatures at night are going to be in the 70s. And so it's really an extended period where it doesn't really cool down at night.
Yeah, and that's a concern in a lot of places, especially those that really don't have, don't have a lot of air conditioning and things like that, like in New England as well. And these high temperatures, you know, are really a concern for everybody, but also the most vulnerable, including the elderly, the really young, and those with respiratory issues. John, do you have any tips for these folks on how to stay safe in this extreme weather?
Yeah, well, certainly plenty of water is a great place to start. And you're right about the vulnerable populations. Don't forget about athletes who may be training, outdoor workers, those with pre-existing conditions. Certainly, I think the simplest advice is if you have to be outdoors, do it before, say, 11 a.m. or sooner if you want to get that walk in, or wait until late in the evening, you know, an hour or two before sunset. to get that outdoor exercise in. But certainly between those times, if you are one of those vulnerable populations, just stay inside if you can.
All right. That's good advice there, John. Really quickly, I mean, I know you've been a meteorologist for a really long time studying weather patterns. Should we be concerned? Is this a sign of things to come, or maybe is it something more cyclical?
Well, I mean, we have hot periods during the summer. This is nothing unusual. I mean, if you're alluding to the idea of climate change, the way to think about climate change is that it simply loads the dice. It makes certain outcomes, in this case, hot weather, a little more likely, like rolling a die that has six sides, and maybe it's not a fair die, and now maybe six comes up a little bit more than one does. That's how climate change sort of fits into this picture.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. John, great to be with you. Thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you for having me, Tracy.
And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including addressing AI, analysis of the Holy Father's recent remarks to world leaders regarding artificial intelligence. And we remember a longtime Catholic radio host who passed away over the weekend. Historic day in Maryland as the governor issues more than 175,000 pardons for marijuana convictions.
So first, I will grant pardons to Marylanders who have been convicted for misdemeanor possession of cannabis. And second, I will grant full pardons to Marylanders who have been convicted of certain misdemeanor possession crimes of drug paraphernalia.
This is the first state to take such action, as Moore described it as the largest pardon to date. However, it will not result in anyone being released from incarceration, and criminal conviction will still show on offenders' records. 24 states and the District of Columbia have legalized recreational cannabis. Well, you see them on boxes of cigarettes and bottles of liquor, and now the Surgeon General wants to put warning labels on social media platforms. Writing in the New York Times, Dr. Vivek Murthy says the warning should reflect that social media is a contributing factor in the mental health crisis among young people. A 2022 study from Pew Research found that 95% of youths ages 13 through 17 use social media. A reaction is still pouring in following remarks from Pope Francis on the future of artificial intelligence. At the G7 summit in Italy, the Holy Father urged world leaders to keep human dignity at the forefront in developing and using AI. He also warned that the powerful technology risks turning human relations into algorithms. The director of the G7 research think tank said the Holy Father was treated like a celebrity, adding that it was important to note that AI poses threats to peace and society if human ethics are left to the side. For analysis of the Holy Father's remarks, we turn now to Matthew Sanders, CEO of Longbeard and creator of Magisterium AI, designed to answer questions about Catholic doctrine. Matthew, great to be with you again. We appreciate it. First off, what stood out to you the most about the Holy Father's comments, and how important do you think it was for the leader of the Catholic Church to weigh in on this?
Well, I think it was hugely important. I mean, I think it's the most important technology to ever have been created. Certainly, I think it'll come to go down as one of the most powerful tools to ever been created. So I think for the Pope to not speak to the issue directly would be weird, and I think wouldn't be in the interest of humanity. I think it's very telling. This is the first time the Pope has ever addressed the G7, and he chose to talk about artificial intelligence. So I think he understands the import of this technology. I think when I finished reading his statement, I think what really impressed me was his grasp of some of the particular issues that we in the industry are grappling with. You know, one is, there's a quote from the document that AI is neither objective nor neutral. And that's very true. AIs are only as good as the algorithms that control them and the data they have access to. And so that data is generated by us human beings, and therefore it's certainly not objective. And the algorithms are hugely influenced by people. And so I think he's seeing out there that people are complaining about AIs having biases. You know, Google had and their Gemini product, which came out recently, very noteworthily, had some bias issues. And so he took the time to actually directly address that to the G7. I think that says a lot that he's well grounded.
Yeah, absolutely. And you may have know this already, but estimates say the artificial intelligence sector is valued at more than $400 billion. Right now, in the next decade, it could be worth around $2 trillion. Matthew, as someone who is part of this space, what do you think of the potential growth here? And should we as a society be excited or concerned about this?
I think its growth will be like nothing we've ever seen in history. And I think that when we talk about artificial intelligence, we also have to remember the important field of robotics. It's AI in robotics that will really, really transform our world. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised in 10 years if half the world's population was gainfully unemployed because of these two technologies. So I think it has the potential of enormous impacts on humanity. And the Pope talked about this in his address. That being said, AI is a tool. So we can wield it to do good or we can wield it to do bad. But it's important to remember that it's not neutral. And so it's going to take regulators spending, you know, meaningful time together to ensure that we're pointing this technology at the most meaningful human problems.
All right. And before I let you go, we have maybe 30 seconds left or so. But quickly, you have any advice for the faithful on ways to get the most out of AI?
Yeah, just to recognize that, you know, it's. The Pope talks about this in his address. It makes decisions about what it puts in front of you based upon statistical probabilities and inferences. So it doesn't actually have the capability of generating any true insight. And that's why the Pope, he warns about this. It can't truly generate new ideas. And so just remember that. I mean, what you're seeing is something repackaged from someone else. And so if you are, you know, endeavoring to think originally and to try and make a contribution, give something new, to society, that you're going to have to still use your head. Unfortunately, AI is not there yet.
All right, great advice. Matthew, thank you so much for your time. I always appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you. God bless.
Awesome. Sad news to report tonight. Al Cresta, longtime Catholic radio host and author, has died. A former evangelical Protestant, Cresta converted to Catholicism back in 1992. His voice was heard on hundreds of radio stations daily, including EWTN Catholic Radio on Cresta in the Afternoon. He later said that the intellectual integrity of the Catholic faith is unlike anything in Protestantism. EWTN President and COO Doug Keck called Cresta's death, quote, a titanic loss for the entire church. Cresta died in Michigan after a battle with cancer. He was surrounded by family and friends. Al Cresta was 72 years old. While it may not be church bells, but it still has a nice ring, that's Cardinal Timothy Dolan, the Archbishop of New York, ringing the opening bell on Wall Street. His Eminence was joined this morning at the New York Stock Exchange by members of Catholic Charities. The Vatican recently released a study document on the role of the Pope. This comes after 3 years of dialogue with other Christian churches and discussions on the authority of the Pope. EWTN Vatican journalist Paola Araza has more.
The Vatican presented a new study document called The Bishop of Rome. This work responds to the invitation of St. John Paul II to other Christians to find the forms in which the ministry of the Pope may accomplish a service of love recognized by all concerned. The document presented by the Dicastery for Promoting Christian Unity surveys the ongoing dialogue between Christian churches concerning the role of the Pope and the exercise of his ministry.
We have the invitation of Pope John Paul II, 95, in his encyclical letter Utunum Sint, he has invited all the churches to enter in a dialogue with him for finding a form of the primacy which not be an obstacle in the future. And we have now many responses and have many ecumenical dialogues. And this document is a synthesis of all this reaction for the invitation of John Paul II.
While most other Christians have varying understandings of the primacy of the Pope, the Catholic Church upholds its divine origins, tracing the doctrine to when Jesus granted a special authority over the entire Church to St. Peter in the Gospel of Matthew. Despite the many different churches and Christian denominations existing today, many theological dialogues have recognized the necessity of a ministry of unity at the universal level. Although Christians in the East and the West used to live in communion in the first centuries, the many dialogues also recognize that such primacy cannot simply be recreated, but that a primacy at the universal level should respond to contemporary challenges.
It's the balance between primacy and synodality. You know, sometimes we have the impression this is a contrary, synodal and primacy. And the document says very clearly about all the ecumenical dialogue, this is complementary. We don't have a synodality without primacy, and we don't have primacy without synodality. And to have a better discussion about this issue in the ecumenical dialogues is very important.
Synodality among the churches, the document argues, could enable the churches to listen to one another and start joint discernment and decision-making processes on urgent matters of shared concern. The document concludes with a proposal from the dicastery, identifying the most significant suggestions made for a renewed exercise of the Ministry of Unity of the Bishop of Rome, recognized by one and all. In Rome, Paola Riaza, EWTN News Nightly.
A final time, Pope Francis reminds the faithful that the seeds of the gospel take time to bloom.
L'atteggiamento è l'attesa fiduciosa.
At a Sunday address at the Vatican, the Holy Father asked the faithful to trust that God is working even when it appears that nothing is happening. Pope Francis says that it's similar to the gospel reading where a farmer plants seeds, they take time to grow to maturity. Now we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.